This episode is sponsored by...
Oh no, we have some bad news. Writing a great book isn't all it takes to be a successful author. That's why we created the Possibilities Conference, where we transform writers into professional authors. Join us on April 7th in Falls Church, Virginia, where you can look forward to the Pancakes with Publishers breakfast, dynamic workshops, even a media lounge where you can leave with free headshots and an author promo video for your media kit. All this and so much more. Grab your tickets at thepossibilitiesconference.com.
Welcome to It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker and a production of the AS21 Podcast Network, brought to you by AS21 Audio. This podcast is available on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and audio.as21.com.
I wanted to do a podcast on female-centric movies built around Lady Bird, and another one on LGBTQ-themed movies around Call Me By Your Name. But the truth is that it's a bit more difficult to do a podcast on New Directions in either theme than it is to do one on New Directions in African-American movies, because both of these themes are baked into the fabric of mainstream movie history from the very beginning. In many ways, it's taken until just the last couple of years for African-American movies to truly explode into the mainstream of movie life as never before. If there is a possibility for a true revolution of representation in either the field of female-centric movies or LGBTQ movies, and I'm certain there is, then it's pretty obvious that it has yet to happen. Nevertheless, they've always been there. Among women, Leni Riefenstahl has, of course, the dubious distinction of being the great director of Nazi Germany. And at the same time, Ida Lupino was one of the great, respected directors of studio-era Hollywood. And there are various directors in various new wave movements, which generally signal an eruption in a country of a more progressive outlook in cinema, or at least certainly hipper, Agnès Varda, and a little later Chantal Ackerman. In France, Vera Chitilova in Czechoslovakia, An Hui in Hong Kong, Marie-Michel Meschkini and Samira Makhmalbaf in Iran, and a whole binder full of women directors in England. Of course, female directors should be a much greater part of that fabric, but they've been unmistakably there all throughout movie history. The same goes still much more so for gay and queer-themed movie making. Whatever discrimination they face in the rest of their lives, gay men have always had an extremely honored place in the arts, perhaps even disproportionately so. And the directors who've made an enormous impact, not just in movies, but with gay-themed or gay-subtexted movies, is practically an honor roll and would make a good podcast of its own, though not this week. There's no cinema as we know it without F.W. Murnau, James Whale, George Cukor, Luchino Visconti, John Waters, Pier Paolo Pasolini, John Schlesinger, Franco Zeffirelli, Rainer Wilhelm Fassbinder, The Merchant Ivory Partnership, Gus Van Sant, Todd Haynes, and not to mention the director who's probably my pick for the greatest living anywhere in the world, Pedro Almodovar from Spain. Anyone who's seen his work knows that he makes movies of incredible intensity, incredible comedy, bizarreness, technique, and all in the service of an overwhelming compassion and human feeling. On the other hand, famous lesbian directors are pretty much non-extant. It might be a little too easy to make this podcast about Lady Bird, which is, in my strong opinion, easily the best of last year's batch of exciting new identity-based movies, or Call Me By Your Name, the most flawed of them, but perhaps the most sociologically interesting. And you could even throw in The Post, which, next to Lady Bird, is perhaps unfairly the second best movie I saw last year. It's the story of Catherine Graham, made by Steven Spielberg, and quite unfairly, the movie in which Spielberg gets to position himself as a progressive feminist after basically ignoring female characters for the entirety of his 45-year career. And if I can't fashion something better, I'll go back and I'll make the podcast on exactly that, even though I find it a little tiresome to repeat the same subject from week to week without any real change. Maybe I'll do that podcast in the next week or two. But there's another subject, a larger one, that grew out of the last 2 weeks' subjects that, for the moment, interest me much more. Instead, I'd like to make this podcast into something about the need, the inescapable need, for identity-themed art, its necessity, and even were it proven to be unnecessary, its inevitability, and what that ultimately means, as best as I can guess, which will no doubt be wrong, for how art will evolve in the 21st century. We just have to face it. Art is not as important to the average middle-class person at the beginning of the 21st century as it was to the average middle-class person at the beginning of the 20th. There are so many reasons for that, but I can't imagine that it doesn't ultimately come down to the much greater importance of science in our lives. Technology is so obviously the node around which modern life revolves. The miracle of art in the 19th century was a linear, thousand-year-long progression in which the creativity of artists piled one innovation upon another until the most detailed, abstract techniques in music or painting or narrative storytelling could show a mirror up to nature that became a heightened version of our own consciousness that illuminated the human experience as it never before could have been, and no doubt arguably never has in quite so vast a way since. All evolution has those moments when, because life becomes so vastly more sophisticated in some areas, it necessarily becomes vastly less sophisticated in others. By the beginning of the 20th century, technology made human evolution so quick that the human experience could not ever again be processed directly without a technological intercessor. Human technology created musical sounds that reproduced without the presence of musicians, and pictures that moved and could tell stories. Everything about the human relationship to art has to be relearned. And when the reset button was pressed, we had to go back to basics. The possibilities of how art could be made were suddenly infinite, and yet the audience for infinite creativity became infinitesimal. And without a large public to learn from, it is much, much harder to figure out what works artistically. That's not to say that there isn't great art of the highest seriousness of purpose made today, but for all the freedom to create however we wish, it is harder than it once was. There are more professional practitioners than ever before, and just about all of us are up against a wall of indifference. Every one of us is creating in a vacuum. How can I, as a composer or whatever else I do, figure out what engages anyone but me when I'm the only person who's listening? I'm sure that there are literally millions of artists who feel the same way. So every time you go to an avant-garde show and laugh at a painter or composer who makes something you don't understand, try to be a little sympathetic to them. Think of the desperation and loneliness that might have gone into sinking their entire financial future into student loans to get a degree in the arts, and think of what kind of work a person talented enough to get into art or music school might have created had somebody paid attention to them other than a professor who tells them to create within the strictures of an ideology that justifies their tenure. And if you ever paid attention to them and gave them an emotional or, God forbid, financial incentive to value your opinion, they would start creating art that you would like. Losing a general middle-class public for new high art was a trauma from which the high arts have never recovered and will not recover until the middle class or something in the future that resembles what we currently call the middle class decides that art, rather than entertainment, is important again. And this, of course, gets us into those murky waters that get everybody angry. What is art versus what is entertainment? What is art versus what is craft? What is art versus what is artisanal? And is there a truly segregating border wall between all of these? And even if it turns out that some things are definitely art and some things are definitely not, is a bad work of art less a work of art than a great work of entertainment or craft? And is this debate even at all something worthwhile or just a vestige of an historical era when the borders between various categories and classes of people weren't nearly so porous as they are today? Is art truly, as so many people articulate today, whatever you believe it to be. Citizens of the internet will never forget the day that Roger Ebert had the temerity to say on his blog that he didn't think video games were art. He's lucky that the pitchforked online mob against him probably hadn't left their rooms for 5 days at a time, or else he'd have died a couple years sooner. But it's a worthwhile question. How can it possibly be art if you can win at it? What, aside from its digitality, separates video games from chess, mahjong, football, baseball? Moves within all of these games can certainly have qualities of art, and can certainly be called artful. But personally, I doubt that anybody who yet believes that any video game is great art has thought for particularly long about the subject. I've sat in enough rooms while friends play the latest iteration of Zelda or World of Warcraft or The Elder Scrolls to be pretty damn certain that it's not there yet. If you've truly been touched by Shakespeare, Rembrandt, Beethoven, Michelangelo, Mozart, Tolstoy, Homer, and thousands of others, yes, including some popular artists, then you see the vast ocean of difference. Maybe it is just bullshit sentimentality, but I do not believe that even the best video games yet created can feed the spirit in a way that's more powerful than religion itself. On the other hand, video games, they do have the means to tell long-form stories in a way not altogether different from cinema. There are all kinds of possibilities in its narrative and pictorial aesthetic. So it's certainly possible that one day, perhaps sooner than we know, there will be a Michelangelo or Shakespeare of role-playing games that presents himself as obviously as Orson Welles presented himself to the movies in America around 1940, and shows what can be done with video games in manners that change the curvature of the human imagination. I'll happily eat my words on that day. I'm not staking my bets on it happening anytime soon, but if it happens within my lifetime, I certainly won't stand in the way of people calling video games genuine art, even great art. Posterity makes fools of us all, and it would be foolish to make a sweeping declaration that video games can never be art, particularly when so many people with enormous Twitter followings think they already are. Fortunately, I don't have the online presence to have anything like Ebert's mob formed against me, but one can understand why people might have felt betrayed by Ebert's sudden lurch against populism. For 40 years, he was at the vanguard of taking things seriously which did not seem serious. There was a Nightline episode in which he and Gene Siskel went up against the infamously venomous critic John Simon of New York Magazine, who called lovers of Star Wars arrested adolescents. Ebert responded correctly that John Simon was prematurely old, though sadly, that poison pen has now outlived both Siskel and Ebert to his mid-90s. Roger Ebert was a great movie critic, albeit one with many flaws. But among the great writers of film, he was the great populist. For nearly 50 years, he treated every movie review with equal seriousness. And whether it was praising a Bergman movie to the skies or panning another generic $200 million Michael Bay action flick, he brought the same incredible gusto to the assignment. When Siskel and Ebert launched on TV, Ebert was able to make cogent arguments about film in real time and showed that anybody could. I remember his movie reviews being online as early as 1997. Between the TV show and his online presence, he really and truly turned two or three generations of movie appreciators into cinephiles, each of whose individual tastes were distinct and respected in discussion. If Pauline Kael launched an army of critics whose careers were contingent on evaluating the quality of movies the way she told them to, then Roger Ebert helped mentor dozens of critics, each with their own individual voice and taste, each of whom brought their distinct insights. And yet, the era of Ebert's populism was also the era that saw cinemas dwindling in importance. By 1980, there was no weekly American ritual of going to the movies. The movies were a special excursion you took because the movies could give you an experience you'd never get from television. Now, art has never been democratic, and it never will be. Whether the genius behind it is male or female, white or black, individual or collective, great art is an authoritarian regime, and if you treat art with the seriousness it seems to demand, you will fight dirty for it and do what's necessary to make what you believe is a great work. If you think the result will be better from doing so, you'll steal your equipment, exploit your staff, disobey your bureaucracy, and debase yourself for the money. The result may well be, as it seems today, that the arts attract a disproportionate surfeit of despicable human beings. But life is not fair. And while art is most certainly related to religion, it clearly does not play by the rules of morality. Any larger-than-life achievement takes people of a temperament willing to commit immoral acts to produce their remarkable results. If their immorality stretches to aspects of life other than their work, who can possibly be surprised? But what Ebert's career shows is that the borders of what constitutes great art are always changing. So whether it's video games or some form of role-playing or still another form of virtual reality, I'm sure there will be some kind of artisanal or crafty digital pursuit which today's more conservative tastemakers consider trivial that by 2100 will seem of such quality that even conservative sticks in the mud, like me, will consider them self-evidently great art. But that does not mean that the definitions of what constitutes great art have expanded. In an era like this, when so many people consider everything artisanal on par with any traditional form of art, we now have to consider whether great fashion designers, great chefs, great gardeners, great knitters should be considered great artists. Certainly, when you hear stories about a lot of famous chefs and fashion designers, you realize that they're as willing to bully their way into creating the best possible work as any great artist. Not that the bullying should be considered in any way a criteria, but it does, in my opinion, demonstrate a kind of perverse devotion to their craft, even if the result may be counterproductive. I am not going to definitively rule that great chefs and fashion designers and gardeners and video game designers and etc. are not art, at least not today, but it's difficult not to believe that if one rules all of their best practitioners capable of being great artists, the nature of what makes great art special is incredibly devalued. Such questions have been entertained before, particularly in interwar Paris, which was rudely interrupted by World War II's black hole of death. If peacetime had continued uninterrupted, perhaps Coco Chanel or a chef like Auguste Escoffier would be considered artists on par with Picasso or Matisse or Monet. You get the point. But what if, and I know it'll sound absurd to a lot of you before I even say it, the kind of radical or liberal or whatever you want to call it, permissiveness, that invites people to believe that a fashion designer or a cook whose products are assembled by a team of dozens is as great an artist as a painter like Picasso who redefined the rules of visual art in 50,000 separate works, the vast majority of which he must have had no help at all to make, in a form of art that was already packed to the gills with history and many people thought could go no further. Anyway, what if calling Coco Chanel as great as Picasso is the same kind of illogic of the human mind that it allows people to believe that some races are innately more intelligent or that some religion might have a secret cabal ruling the world? Obviously, one type of illogic is a much more destructive illogic than the other. And if the choice between being mad about having to think about certain artisans as artists is versus being mad about racism and anti-Semitism, obviously we should just forget about what makes us mad in the arts completely. But that's not the point. The point is that the developments in the arts are as good a way to register changes in society as any. If journalists begin to write think pieces saying that we should take chefs or graphic designers with the same seriousness as Beethoven, that's a very radical thought. And very few radical thoughts occur in isolation. So if you're saying something like that chefs or graphic designers should be taken with the same seriousness as Beethoven, it stands to reason that such a radical notion is being said at the exact same time that perhaps capitalism should be overthrown. So if there are radical thoughts that percolate in the air, they will create new radical thoughts. And then there will inevitably be a counter-radical backlash to resist it, and these two sides will inevitably come into conflict. So what if such a level of radical thought is what invites reactionary backlash? And by so expanding the playing field of what constitutes a legitimate option, We've completely destroyed the restraints we can use to fight against ideas that we know are lethal poison. Again, I know it sounds absurd to many people to equate radical egalitarianism about art with the kind of intellectual poison that creates demagogy, but it's hard, at least for me, not to see an enormous correlation. I'll come back to that thought later, but in the meantime, against Roger Ebert, let's consider Kenneth Clark.
The next 30 seconds may not be suitable for all audiences as it discusses suicide.
This episode is sponsored by...
Suicidal thoughts are not harmful. Suicide kills. Everyone has a relationship with something unholy they have preferred. That unholy thing soils the vessel where a holy God cannot dwell. Thank God for Jesus Christ that blankets us with the blood of Jesus, allowing us all of God, a mind's road to redemption. My Dear Suicide by Onowabuchi Ayozi, now available in paperback from Amazon and Lulu, or ebook for Kindle, Apple, Kobo, or Nook, or www.onowabuchi.webs.com.
Even by 1969, Kenneth Clark, the once hugely famous English art critic, could declare on his once hugely famous television miniseries, Civilization, that cinema is ephemeral and nothing from it could be considered art of importance. He's been proven obviously risibly wrong, and already had long since by 1969. But for his generation, Clark was at least a kind of populist. He was a director of London's National Gallery who believed that great art was the inherent right of all people, regardless of social station. During the war, he opened up the National Gallery, then emptied of its contents to keep it from being destroyed during the war, to free concerts virtually every night. After the war, he became the chairman of Britain's first commercial network, and he took it on himself to try to create programming, as so many 50s TV executives did, that was both intellectually elevating and commercially viable. Believe it or not, there were many people who disagreed with him about the ability of the quote-unquote lower classes to be enriched by art in the way that he said they could. Now it just seems a little silly to condescend to the unwealthy in that way, but we do have to try to see things within the lens of their own time and place. If you ever watch Civilization, be charitable. Don't be taken in by Kenneth Clark's upper-class twit demeanor. Civilization is obviously a work of its time, and Clark was an emissary from a generation of war that had seen death and suffering unimaginable to most of the world today. The intellectual survivors of the generation like his ought to be forgiven for thinking that any work which makes any concessions to mass appeal at all is a work that makes light of suffering, or a work that can be co-opted for nefarious propaganda. What Clark wanted was to make a series that brought us unwashed masses up to the level of the art he displayed rather than bringing the art down. And in that sense, Civilization is a very great TV show and of a progressivism we would all do well to emulate. So Clark was a conservative whom, as he aged, came to see that a certain kind of mass appeal was not something to revile. Ebert was a progressive whom, as he aged, came to see that the same is true about a certain kind of elitism. Now, the vast majority of British and Americans who watched Civilization on its first run had enormous experience of an era of suffering that dwarfs our own. In a state of suffering, the need for worship, for believing that there is something in the world, either a god or a human achievement, that justifies existence in this one and promises us that we can transcend a planet that can sometimes seem like an oppressive black hole, is what lets people move on from their suffering. And it is in these moments when entertainment seems like obscenity that the need to seek out a more transcendent consolation becomes particularly acute. Think of the past millennium of Christian art and music and ask yourself, why is it that art and religion seem to have gone so hand in hand for so long, and why does it go less hand in hand today? Think of what the world was before the Industrial Revolution and modern medicine. It was a given that some of your children would die in childhood. Women had no recourse for spousal abuse, men had no recourse for exploitation by their employers, and neither had much recourse to the ravages of war or crime. In such an environment, religion almost isn't enough. To live on, perhaps only art could remind them of the ability to transcend this world to a celestial plane where all the suffering of this world will be escaped. Now, entertainment is escapism too, but it's a very different kind of escapism. Entertainment is intended as distraction. It puts you, by definition, in a state of mind that makes you no longer concerned with any thought that you might not transcend those circumstances you don't like. Art does not, as the cliché goes, take you out of yourself. Rather, it changes your sense of self. It puts your sense of self in the context of much larger things that we can only apprehend on the dimmest levels. We begin to comprehend it through interconnections of meaning, particularly the interconnections of meaning within a work of art. And great art is those creative objects which can be contemplated endlessly over the course of a lifetime with meanings that evolve in one's head from month to month. The art about art is not about how the work makes us feel, but how it makes us perceive. And if our perception of its meaning changes starkly with every encounter, it is most definitely art. Now, Ebert was a kind of critic for a new art form in a new kind of country with a new kind of ethos. 40 years younger than Clark, a populist evangelizer for what must already be counted the most popular form of art in the history of the world. There was already plenty of art in the movies that aimed for quite a bit more than diversion by the time Ebert's career began and Clark's career drew down. Ebert's 15 years of articles called The Great Movies made a pretty good case for which movies they might be. But Ebert could be as unashamedly lowbrow as he was highbrow. What he termed Ebert's law is that a movie is not about what it is about, but how it is about it. What this meant in practice was, to paraphrase Marx, each movie according to its own ability, each according to the movie's need. A Schwarzenegger action movie would be as highly praised in its way as a work by Werner Herzog or Kubrick, which he thought transcendent, because each accomplished what it set out to do. It would be foolish to keep Ebert out of any list of the greatest movie critics, with Pauline Kael and Andrew Saras and David Thompson and Stanley Kaufman and James Agee, Robert Warshaw, Jonathan Rosenbaum, André Bazin, Jay Hoberman, and Manny Farber, and for that matter, Godard and Truffaut, and the rest of the French New Wave, and Bogdanovich and Schrader. The reason to repeat all these names is to show not just how intellectually active the world of movies was at its prime, but how much movies mattered to so many people that the most eminent writers about movies were intellectual rock stars in their own right. Ebert won his Pulitzer and went on to television in the same year, 1975, and that was the exact year Jaws completely changed the DNA of Hollywood. By the time of Star Wars and Indiana Jones, more highfalutin cinema was considered to have no more right to prestige than excellent entertainments like Star Wars and Indiana Jones. Yet even if more people flocked to certain movies in quantities unheard of just a few years earlier, people flocked less often to movies in general. 75 was almost exactly the year of the break in which movies ceased to matter in American life like daily bread. I'm on deadline here, so please, if you must, just take it on faith that there are a lot of statistics to back this assertion up, and if you disagree, email me at etucker82@gmail.com, and when I have time, I'll search for the results that will hopefully be to your satisfaction. The audience for art film in the movie's heyday was surprisingly large, but it certainly wasn't the same size as the audience for Charlton Heston or Julie Andrews. But because movies were so much a part of daily life, it was a given that people of particular intelligence would look for a more complex level of movie. It's the same with television today, and again, the coincidence is rather striking. In 2011, Game of Thrones premiered and moved the tastes of the larger public away from the heightened realism you get in Mad Men and Breaking Bad and The Sopranos and The Wire to a new form of escape whose mental demands were almost completely visceral rather than contemplative. The same year, 2011, was the year that Netflix announced it was separating its DVD rental service from its streaming service. 2 years later, Netflix had 3 TV shows earning Emmy nominations. A year after that, Netflix had 31 Emmy nominations. The model for how TV is made was broken. with shows suddenly binge-watched and therefore needing more hooks to keep the viewers interested for hours at a time, and beloved shows from the distant past got resurrected, usually not as good as the first runs. Some people say that Netflix is an entirely new golden age of TV, with more good options than ever. And I know that Netflix provides a lot of great content. I particularly love BoJack Horseman, and I eagerly look forward to watching Orange is the New Black, but for the sheer battalion of content they're generating, much of which I've seen, I hasten to add, I would think that there would be a better show on it than a show about an aging celebrity horse. And furthermore, I just don't see how their business model can last when the internet can provide so much good free content and so many mediocre distractions. Now, this is an entirely arbitrary point to stop, but there's just so much to say about all this that we're just going to have to continue next week, and hopefully I won't get bored. Thanks so much, and see you then.
Much of what happens, what is discovered now, will of course be secret. We will not be given the full answer.
This has been It's Not Even Past, A History of the Distant Present, hosted by Evan Tucker. This has been a production of the AS21 Podcast Network and brought to you by AS21 Audio. Find this and other episodes on Podomatic, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn, and our home on the web, audio.as21.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/itsnoteven past. That's it for this episode, but we'll be back, because the past isn't dead, it's not even past.
Copyright 2018, AS21 Media, LLC. All rights reserved. AS21 Media. What do you want your story to be?